dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 239, and look, we're aging like wine. I'm your host, Ify Whitey Way, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the world's favorite critic, the Christmas Zaddy himself, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
What's good, Ify, is Pizza Party, and Pizza Party is a spice blend that you can get from a company called Burlap and Barrel. Now, if you are a fan of cool, fun online chef videos, then you probably know Sola El Wali. Sola and her husband Ham have this company now, and they're putting out different sort of food related things. And my husband Dave White is, of course, a big fan of Sola and all she does. So got us some Pizza Party, and it is a thing that you sprinkle on anything, eggs onto, you know, salads, whatever, and it just brings that Italian seasoning, but a little tomato, and like it makes the pizza action happen. So, you know, in this world where we are trying to just get jazzy with it, you know, I find Pizza Party does the trick.
Yeah, we can no longer say get jiggy with it.
No.
In light of Sunday's event, we have to say get jazzy with it. As the resident meathead, that's been a huge thing, is like there's all these like very like extra seasonings that go for a whole, like, you know, flavor instead of like this seasoning, because since you're making like, you know, seven different roasted chickens, you want to throw different seasons on them to trick yourself into thinking you're having something else.
Now you can have a pizza chicken.
Yeah, why not?
Sounds very jazzy.
Yeah. You know someone else who's very jazzy? Probably the jazziest person on the Midwest. It's the queen of the Midwest, Drea Clark herself. Powerful programmer, producer. What's good?
Yep. Thousands of miles from the Midwest. But yes, in absentia.
Queen in exile.
Yes. No one's ever referred to me as jazzy before. So thank you, Ify. What's good with me, you guys know this, but in like December, I had this barnacle appear on my face between my eyes. It looked as if my face was really hoping to grow a unicorn horn. And after months of tribulation and biopsies, which were thankfully benign, I had it removed. And then I got my stitches out on Friday, last Friday. So
yay.
Now I just have, a like Harry Potter scar in the middle of my face. But the good part is, nobody enjoys doing skincare more than this gal. So the like vitamin E scar massage, I'm wearing silicone like scar shields all the time. I'm telling you, I'm going to kick its ass.
Is this a cocoa butter sitch or no?
No, not yet. This is still like in the very, because, you know, I just had surgery 2.5 weeks ago.
Gotcha.
But eventually. But anyway, I'm very happy to be, what's good is to be on the recovery side of things.
Okay.
Right. And so I'm going to forever be referring to this as the year that I had some work done.
Yeah, LA lady.
But yeah, now you have your, you know, producer Harry Potter scar, and it'll start hurting whenever the crew starts pushing into lunch. You're like,
we're going to double overtime somewhere. What's happening? Yeah.
You can't go back to the Midwest now.
Yeah, they're going to say you've gone Hollywood. Oh, well, that other voice that you heard, those sweet, dulcet tones, is none other than Todd Mezzero, TV producer and car expert. What's good?
Woohoo!
Well, sweet and dulcet tones, I don't know. Usually it's just turn down the volume. But for me, what's good is basketball. I'm actually back playing full court basketball with my regular group of guys. Still wearing a mask because that's just how I'm going to go for a while. But there's kind of nothing like getting on the court and hobbling up and down and making a basket now and then and a good pass or two. So basketball, that's what's good.
That's fantastic. Wow. I mean, just the communal side of that, let alone being able to run around. Those are the things that I live in a bunker, and the things that we've missed out on, those are the small ones of, ooh, wow, you really took for granted just being able to go run around a court with people.
I can't even come up with a decent March Madness bracket, which I got roped into doing again by the Deck the Hallmark guys, and it was embarrassing.
That's impossible, though.
This year was not a year. Yeah.
I thought Kentucky was going all the way. What can I say?
Everybody did. It's Kentucky. I will say shout out to my brother-in-law who went to St. Peter's, the school that no one heard of before like a month ago.
And apparently, if you aren't going with Gonzaga, you're just doomed from the start. That's what I'm being told now.
Gonzaga's them too? Gone. Oh, yeah, okay. Gonzaga's then great.
No one, no one knows anything.
Gonzaga, more like Gonzaga.
Iffy. We just turned into sports radio.
Iffy, apart from that joke, what's good?
Yes.
Oh, what's good with me is if anyone in here watches Chef's Table and the artistry that is that show. Mm-hmm. This weekend I went to Inaka, which was like hard. Again, I am someone who you know fights teenagers for exclusive sneakers, and getting a reservation was harder than even that. but I did get one. And I went, and all 13 of those courses were amazing. I had the wine and sake pairing. It was great. Everyone gets excited when I tell them about it, and then their excitement stops when I tell them how much I paid for it. Before you ask, it was $1,100 for me and Molly's anniversary dinner. But when I say,
wow,
and it may be hard to believe, but it was worth every penny.
Hey, if you're going to do a keto cheat day, do a keto cheat day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, you get to come out and meet the chef, and like, because she comes out, because she's in there.
She should be giving
night.
You a ride home.
Well, what?
The chef should also be your Uber.
And a foot rub.
Or a suborbital flight, like on Branson's ship.
Yeah, it's like hella intimate. There's like probably like 7 or 8 tables in there. So like there's not that many people. And like when you go to the bathroom, they reset your table, and the bathrooms have like the Japanese bidets. So I'm like, okay, at least y'all spared no expense. You know, if I was pissing on ice, I'd be like, all right.
Iffy, did you pick up the phrase hella intimate from Chef's Table? Or was that in the know,
you know, yeah, yeah, hella intimate, and you know, tasting notes, or something. I say a lot now.
Mon Dieu.
Mm-hmm. Well, you, speaking of French, we're gonna wrap our minds around.
Speaking of French.
We're gonna wrap our minds around. Yeah, you. Oui.
C'est vrai.
Well, we're going to wrap our minds around Julia Ducournau's French horror thriller, Titane. Then we'll keep our car love going with an auto-themed Hall of Excellence, which I'm excited about because, you know, y'all know I'm part of the Fast family. So car, you know, motor oil runs through my veins, and the other vein is filled with Corona. And, you know, just in general, we'll get into the car stories at that portion of the episode.
Consider yourself warned.
Yeah. But right now, it's time for Itadick.
Yay.
Itadick is our segment where we go through movie news together and decide as a group, a unit.
Nay, a family.
Nay, a family. A Fast family.
Certainement.
Is this important? Do we care? So we're going to kick things off with Alonzo. Let's touch on something.
Well, you know, it's the first show since last weekend's Oscars, so we couldn't not bring it up, even though it's a good 5 days old now. It was a night of firsts and seconds. Ariana DeBose, first openly queer woman of color to win an acting Oscar. Jane Campion became the first woman to win Best Director the second year in a row that a woman was given that award. Only the third in the 94 years of this organization. The second deaf acting winner, Troy Kotsur, for Coda, following in the footsteps of his co-star Marley Matlin, and of course first on stage assault. We could fill a whole Itadick segment, maybe even a whole episode with all the stories, but you know, this is Friday by the time this is live, and all the hot takes have been hot tooken, so let's just weigh in on all the other stuff from this Oscar night, the actual awards, which are barely being talked about this week. Is this important? Do you care?
I think one of the other firsts that's been significant on the industry side, like on what is it, Inside Baseball kind of track, is that Coda was the first best picture to win that was distributed by a streamer. It was an Apple Plus.
And the first best picture winner to have premiered at Sundance.
That's right.
Wow, really?
Yep.
Yeah, you know that Netflix is just so furious for all the all the money they have put into, like, Roma and The Irishman.
Apple stole their thunder.
Yeah.
Looking back on this is fascinating because I went back and listened to the Breakfast All Day review that we did of Coda. And when that movie dropped on Apple Plus, at the time we were complaining that they were barely promoting it. And I'm realizing now they were just biding their time. They were saving their money and they were just going to go full court press on this awards thing. And clearly it worked.
Also, it's the second year in a row women won screenplay and director in both categories, both the last 2 years. So it's been some,
Coda's amazing story. But the thing that I am really annoyed with that no one is talking about hardly is the fact that the editing Oscar got relegated to, you know, a pre-recorded event. You know the old saying, a film is made three times, right?
Right.
When it's written, when it's shot, and when it's edited. So a third of what makes a film was, like, just sort of treated like yesterday's laundry or, you know.
The bad decisions of this Oscars were just, like, staggering because they took all these major categories out, a bunch of the shorts categories.
Eight of
them. Makeup, score, editing.
Yeah.
You know, took the, you know, dumped them into the pre-show schmoskers and sort of clumsily edited them into the show.
You got to trademark that.
Well, no, that's an old, Kathy Griffin used to call the Emmy Technical Arts the Schmemmies, so I'm just borrowing that. But, you know, so first they do that with the intention of, A, getting a younger demographic that is never going to watch the show and doesn't even have terrestrial TV or care about it. And B, this show ran longer than any Oscar since 2018. So it didn't even trim up the show, which was the stated purpose of doing it. So
it was like 30 minutes longer than last year when they aired not only all 23 categories, but they didn't cut off any speeches.
Cutting off the Drive My Car guy when he won for Best Friend. You know, all the jokes about, like, Power of the Dog was so boring and, this Emmy this Oscar museum is stupid. And, like, it felt hostile towards movies all night.
Yeah. Okay. Y'all are making good points, but how else are we going to fit in the Zack Snyder Speed Force scene to let us know it was the coolest fan moment? One that no actual, even the people that they wanted to get didn't want to see that. They just got hacked by the weird Snyderverse people.
Yes, both of those things existed so they could somehow shoehorn Spider-Man No Way Home into the show. And instead, they left it to the internet, which means the Zack Snyder people who had nothing better to do managed to vote up these two movies, one of which, incidentally, has yet to ever play in a movie theater. Zack Snyder's Justice League went straight to HBO Max, so if you cheered for that movie, you were on your sofa by yourself.
Oh my God. That said, ratings were up like 30% over last year. They were still terrible overall comparison to pre-pandemic, but they were up, and they were up well before any of the Will Smith moment happened. And I really hope the Academy doesn't take the wrong lesson from that.
Ooh. Yeah. Maybe it was the success of the comedians. Like, for me, I know this goes to your point, though, Alonzo, about deriding the films. But the funniest moment of the entire night was Amy Schumer slamming Aaron Sorkin.
Oh, when she
that it was genius on Sorkin's part to make a movie about the funniest woman in Hollywood without a single laugh.
That was amazing. Was
genius. And so it got off to a really good start as far as I was concerned. And then it went downhill
I think there's like a balance of, like, you can sort of goof on things and you can maybe kind of goof on the way people feel about stuff. But like I didn't get why the dig at Last Duel, for instance, felt like, why are we picking on that movie? It's not like it's Cats or something, you know. I don't know. It was just bringing out the, like, you know, Tony Hawk for the 007 montage, like just a lot of things that did not seem to make any sense. And so much of the show seemed designed to, like, win over people who weren't going to watch it and to actively repel people who like watching the Oscars and care about the mission of these awards.
Yeah, agreed 100%. I will say the stage was pretty cool. I thought that, you know, the design of the stage was at least visually engaging, and it changed over
the course
of the night.
They're
going to
put that at the top of their ads for next year.
You'll leave humming the sets.
Come check out our stage.
We got some.
No, they're going to put the slap at the top of the ads.
That's true.
Stay tuned for more Oscar action.
You know, speaking of actions, it seems like there's a plan for a Sonic Cinematic Universe, because now, you know, you can't just have a movie. It has to be a whole universe. An embargo on Paramount's Sonic the Hedgehog 2 was lifted Monday, and with it, some comments from producer Toby Asher. Asher said that adding beloved characters like Tails and Knuckles into the sequel was part of creating the STHECU, Sonic the Hedgehog Extended Cinematic Universe. There's already a third movie and a Paramount TV series in the works. Is this important? Do you care?
Can I tell you why I think this is important? Because every word of what you just said made me so cognizant of my own mortality and how long I've been on this planet. Because I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. I did not know that there were characters named Tails and Knuckles. And I'm a gal who likes to think she's at least adjacent to the zeitgeist, right? Like,
yeah.
So is Sonic the Hedgehog. It's not really in the zeitgeist.
The years are speeding by me.
Yeah, I would say that is definitely a failing on your part, because this is from our shared generation, Dre. Like this isn't where it comes off. Now, if we would have been talking about Biggs the Cat and Shadow the Hedgehog, then that's when it started being in the new one. Sonic and Knuckles were the, like, tentpole characters. My big gripe about this...
Sonic's a game, right? It's a video
game? It's a
game,
but, like, I feel like when you make a cinematic universe, it's, like, things under a larger kind of, like, narrative umbrella. This is, like, just a series. Like, it's not a cinematic... It's just a series and spinoffs. Stop making everything a cinematic universe. We don't need them. We did the thing with the Marvel heroes. Y'all did it. We won. We made it. It's cohesive, and we're milking it to shit. We don't need any more. We can't shut down any more of these smaller studios so that instead of Titan next year, we're talking about Biggs the Cat's Wild Adventure. And Alonzo has already gone missing for some reason because he said movies are dead. And he refused to come on the podcast. We can't have that. We've done it. We don't need it. Just make the movie. Because also, I think another thing that happens is, like, Marvel kind of was a lightning in the bottle thing, because they were trying to create a cinematic universe, but they weren't trying to, if that makes any sense. Like, they were just trying to make this big, larger than life, cohesive story. It's kind of like when they tried to make the Dark Universe, and they put the cart before the horse and it blew up, because instead of making one good movie, you're sitting up here trying to make a cohesive world, and then when you're making the world, you forgot that at the core of that, you need good movies. Y'all almost fucked up the first Sonic. Y'all barely got by. Stop talking about the cinematic universe. Nail number two, because I don't know.
The first Sonic's the one that, like, the audiences complained about how he looked in the trailer, right? And then he did him.
They almost made it look
so
horrible.
I'm just making
sure
I have this exact art in mind.
I was thinking of the Fritz the Cat universe would be
so now I'm there. I'm Sonic. There. Horny animal universe? Let's go. I'll do it. So we'll do that.
There is something almost comforting about an announced cinematic universe that I know I don't have to pay any attention to.
Oh, that's
like,
true.
I am already sitting this one out and not stepping in at any moment.
Yes, I'm with you 100%, Alonzo. I'm where you are. Could care less.
So basically what I'm hearing is Sonic the Hedgehog is bringing us all together.
Yeah,
that's what I got.
And look, if he is telling you to slow your roll on your video game adaptation movie, clearly you're making a mistake somewhere.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah, that's well said. But, you know,
are we going to say more things? Well,
that's why we don't do segues. We will say more things. But first, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, it's going to get weird because we're talking about Titan. See y'all in a hot second. Yo, what's up, y'all? My fellow coffee heads. Look, I was tasting some coffee from Panther, Fazenda de Pedra. And I gotta say, it's delicious. And I also had something from Cafe Vita, the Sumatra Gallo River, that was nice. And Anodyne's Guatemala La Cometa. And you might be like, Iffy, how are you tasting all these different coffees from different places? Well, allow me to tell you about my friends at Trade Coffee.
Indeed. Iffy has friends everywhere, but his friends at Trade Coffee, their whole thing is pairing people with magical beans. If the kind of magic you are looking for is good tasting coffee, not actual magic. And what's very cool about this and the specialty pairings is they are so confident that they're going to do right for you that if they don't the first time, they will get your feedback. And then an actual expert who knows coffee, like we know the Midwest and film criticism, amongst us. That's it. That's the end of our expertise. But they'll work with you and send you a brand new bag for free to match your heart's desire.
And right now, Trade is offering new subscribers a total of $30 off your first order plus free shipping. When you go to drinktrade.com/maxfilm, that's more than 40 cups of coffee for free. Get started by taking their quiz at drinktrade.com/maxfilm and let Trade find you a coffee you'll love. That's drinktrade.com/maxfilm for $30 off.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ivy Whiteway. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Todd Mezzero,
Alonso Duraldi.
Today's movie won the Palme d'Or in 2021. It is now streaming on Hulu. If you Google Titan, you'll see that people ask, is Titan gross? Is Titan worth seeing? And is Titan French? Well, we've already answered one of those questions, and I bet we'll get to all the others before it's over. But first, Alonso, you are so lucky to do the honors to tell us, what is Titan all about?
Golly. Okay. Alessia is a dancer at car shows. She has an intimate relationship with automobiles, far better than she does with other human beings, perhaps tracing back to a terrible auto accident that she was in as a child that left her with a plate in her head and a scar that she continues to proudly present. She needs to go on the lam at some point, and so she disguises herself as the long-missing son of a fire chief winds up living with him, assuming the role of the fire chief's son, even though she is also pregnant and not by a person. And it just kind of goes from there. This is not a movie you really describe. You just kind of have to see it for yourself. But it's extraordinary, and it's Titan.
Yep.
It's extraordinary, and it's Titan, I think, is the great description. You could have just said that.
That's going to enter that phrase. It's so Titan. the lexicon.
You're looking very Titan tonight.
Her first film was about this student. Basically, she it's cannibalistic. How's that? It has a whole thing, but in the same way of not really being able to describe Titan without getting into whatever. Ra is similar, and I think that Julia is an incredibly strong, confident director. She's very evocative and her own thing. Like, certainly the body horror and the cringe. There were moments in this movie when I was like, we can be done now. I'm okay. We can be done now. Thank you. I got it. Thank you.
You were doing the thing where you hide half the screen with your fingers.
Did I mute? Did I mute? I did. I was like, I got it. I got what she wants to do to her face right now. I got it.
Oh, yeah. The nose breaking scene. One was even for me.
That was pretty rough. Was rough.
And it's one of those tricky things because it so much speaks to the talent that she has to like put you in these visceral, intense moments and you feel them and you're like, oh, I'm horrified. Like, that is a skill to get you there. But also, I do not like that flavor. So I'm like, oh, I'm still here. I'm still here. Oh, my God, with the nose. Yeah.
Early on, I was getting a Cronenberg's Crash vibe, yes, because of all the automotive stuff. And there is definitely a Cronenbergian through line of sorts. But she's doing her own thing. I had not seen Raw until after seeing Titan, and then I finally went back. I was like, okay, April Wolf's been telling me for years I need to see this movie, and now I'm going to see it. And now I'm just seeing over the course of these two features, like, somebody who is clearly drawing inspiration from Cronenberg and other filmmakers of that ilk, but absolutely, like, forging her own path and finding new ways to explore what, you know, what we mean when we talk about ourselves and our bodies, and the way that she uses these horrifying moments to then really more deeply explore character and character relationships and parents and children and motherhood and all these different aspects of the story. It's riveting. I really think that, you know, this is somebody who's two movies in and is already like a major global presence in terms of telling this kind of story. And I'm fascinated to see where it all goes from here.
Well, I have the absolute opposite reaction, because for me, the value of having seen this movie is I can now use the phrase, that's so Titan. But other than that, I could easily have done without this movie. And I completely acknowledge the power and impact of some of these scenes, but it felt like, and not every movie has to be a very beginning, middle, and an end. And, you know, we know the decision at the end of the second act that propels the conclusion. Like, it doesn't all have to be formulaic in any way, shape, or form. But this just felt like an incoherent mess. And I think in a lot of people's minds, she's French. And so, you know, we can deconstruct it, or we can talk about semiotics and all these references and motherhood. And, like, I get all those metaphors, but it didn't work for me. It's like, and
I would argue it's a coherent mess.
Okay, well, that, yeah, I might be willing to agree with that.
I think you're on.
About semi-coherent.
Yeah, I think you're onto something, because there is something really challenging about the storytelling in this, in that it does seem like the kind of thing, and also you do get this with a lot of horror in general, but you're like, oh, I'm going to be given metaphor, right? Like, this is going to be meaning something significant, or it's going to be meaning something relatable. Like, at the end of this, I'm going to have a step back and be like, oh, this was about, and Titan is not interested in that. Like, Titan is not interested in, and even your lead character of Alexia, when you first meet her and she has her first moment of violence where she attacks this man who's, like, getting very forward with her, and she's sort of vulnerable. She's just been a dancer in this club, and she stabs him, and you're like, oh, well, that's a lot of stabbing, but maybe fuck that guy. And then she kills a lot more people, and you're like, oh, you're a sociopath. Oh, I get it. Like, oh, you're more machine than mortal. Like, and then the whole, it does take such a big twist, but yeah. I do find it kind of fun to puzzle through those. Like, the fireman who adopts her, for lack of a better, less revealing term, he is performing bodily harm to himself as well. So there's something there about, like, what people will do to their bodies to fit certain standards. Like, do you know what I mean? There's food for thought. But Iffy, what were you going to say?
No, I was going to say, ironically, this kind of reminds me of what we were talking about with Drive My Car. Because when we were talking about how, like, the credit sequence comes in so late and everything before that feels like a prologue to the actual movie, that's what I felt about her life before. Like, the movie to me is from when she's adopted onwards. Mm. But to understand why she's so weird and so, like, fucked up, and, like, why, like, we get this pre, you know, life thing with her and her old family, and, like, basically from her getting the plate up until the family's literal end, and now we pick up with her trying to fit in and her not really wanting to, but having to, you, like, why is she sticking around? Well, she's kind of trying to lay low. And when she gets the moment of wanting to leave, she has now connected with this weirdo, roided out dad. And that's when I turned around on it. Cause I was the same way. I was with Todd where I was like, what are we doing? Like, I was down to the sexy murder party, and now we're like, she's like doing this life. And then when she finds him there with the steroids, and like, you see that she sees something within that and has that connection, I was like, okay, all right, I'm back on board. You pulled me back in, and it was kind of fun.
I know what did it, Iffy. It was the dancing.
Yeah. Well, because I was like, okay, this is going to be a horny movie, but that's then wasn't.
That's a great scene.
The other thing we learned is that French firemen dance with each other and really enjoy it.
I am grateful for that knowledge and visual. I'll take that with me forever. Actually, though, the dancing and though, because there's a few moments of dancing, right? Like, you have her first, like, very performative, and then it's reflected back to again later, but the dancing as a connective, again, nothing that I would expect. Like, your average filmmaker is not going to put in a G storyline about, like, dancing as something that connects. And I did find it, like, contradictory. Like, it's her original family that we see her with, fine, oblivious people, certainly, possibly, like, could be more too, but by no means were they malevolent, were they abusive. Like, there's nothing like that. So I was like, oh, I'm learning that this is a person with no emotions. And then, like, oh no, you have emotions. That's why I was like, again, I kept needing to sort of check my, like, A to B to C, or equals, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that she and the fire chief are both damaged, and then, but they find each other in a way that, you know, as they say, they have matching luggage, you know.
Yeah.
Matching baggage.
What was kind of funny to me about the dancing storyline was kind of how, like, homophobic all these firemen were, but they get shirtless and dance together. And I was like, that in its own way is kind of saying something, because I see a lot of men who don't see that, like, who do, like, the same thing where it's like, yeah, you're like, as a joke, grabbing your friend's balls, but then you want to freak out when there's a gay dude on your basketball team.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole other thing where it's basically like those dudes have to be, like, extra homophobic to then be, for it to be okay that they're in these huge sort of homosocial, you know, all dude only sausage party spaces. And so then the response that they have when they see her dance and think that she's a guy, but, you know, she's got the moves, you know, sort of everybody has to kind of question things. And so I love that moment. You know, I agree with you.
Yes. That moment was great. And I mean, yeah. there were some really compelling scenes in it that did make you think interesting things.
So one of the things that Alonso said, and that we won't get too into, but when Alexia leaves her original family and is adopted, she is in the guise of a young man. And so part of it, like, is her head is shaved and she's binding herself. She's also pregnant, so she's binding a pregnant belly. And there were times when I was wondering, oh, is this, again, I kept coming to, like, what is this? What's my takeaway? What is this film doing? And there were times when I genuinely was like, is this film doing something really interesting with gender as a construct? Or is it just fully, like, setting up the absurdity of how these two people know each other, so we know that it's just more about them being kindred? Did any of the sort of the gender hiding, swapping, was any of that standing out to anyone?
I definitely was thinking about just the mechanics of, like, how do you bind a pregnant belly? But I thought, you know what, we're in the realm of the metaphorical here. Let's not get too bogged down in the actual, like, you know.
What's the metaphor? Alonso, will you send it to me after class?
I wasn't entirely sure about how that was, what that was necessarily communicating, but I kind of felt like, clearly we're not operating at a level where we're taking this in a literal way, but that she is sort of straddling this line of, of being male presenting and at the same time also being pregnant, although pregnant in a very unusual way and having that wreak very unusual effects on her body, that kind of thing. In a weird sort of poetic sense, like, I think this all makes sense, but I would have to, like, pin it all down to the ground and try and, like, walk through it. But as I was watching it, I just very quickly got to the place of, okay, yeah, sure,
whatever. Yes. Who knows what the hell's going to happen next? Because from the very beginning, yeah, the thing that disappointed me, and I'm not a big Cadillac fan, but she's in love with this car, and then she just abandons it. I felt
she's
really
in
bad
lust
for the
with
Cadillac.
The car. Todd,
it was a
sometimes
one-nighter.
You're just horny for yeah, something, yeah, you know? Like, it's not meant to be true love. It's just two souls connecting.
Todd, you are a car guy, so maybe yeah, address a little bit of that, how that presents
yeah,
in the film.
Identified and with the car, you're right. And but car, you know, and no, it also made me think of Christine, of course, because I was wondering if the car didn't only impregnate her, but also dialed up her malevolent behavior in
oh,
some way.
The had car was definitely seducing her. Yeah. The car, it was not
right,
a one-sided
on the
love
door
affair.
While she was in the shower.
It fully was calling out to her. And Todd, you are a car expert. Do cars do that?
Sure. Cars jump up and down. But they don't impregnate people, as far as I know.
Do you have to buy American? Is that what that is?
Well, this is a very American car in a French movie, and I'm sure that's also a metaphor for something.
Well, yeah, now we're going to get into where, you know, if he's nitpicky corner. Because, well, first, I think my car comment was going to be, I love that they had to be married to this lowrider because that's the only type of car they would get with the hydraulics that can do the jumping that it needed in that scene. It was like, oh, this had to be a lowrider. Like, they had no choice because it came as... But also, like...
Also, yeah, she'd look a little weird if she was riding on a Passat, you know?
a Le Car.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, like, you know, this film was willing to show me everything. You just go the extra step. How is she fucking this car? Like, because she seems like she's in the back seat. At first, I thought it was the stick shift, but I'm like, no, logistically, it's not working. It just seems like her lower half was just in the general mid area. If anything, it's on the center console. What's going on there?
Look, I always hear about young ladies getting up to things in the back seats of cars, and that's really all I know, so I just bought it. You know?
Alonso avoided all of those ladies in back seats for this long, and you probably watched it in action, and you were like, thank God. I will say my favorite element of this movie was I knew that my best friends from college would never see it, and I texted them for 2 hours straight my thoughts as I watched it, and 8 middle-aged women across the country being like, wait, what did you just say? As I was describing each moment.
Oh, yeah.
Is probably the preferred way to view this. I highly recommend that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a wild ride, just truly top to. And I'm someone who likes body horror, like that stuff I do like. But it was even pushing me to my limit with some of the most simplest things, like the scratching at it. Like that one was driving me wild because the sound design on it too. And I was like, it was like better when it did break through, because I'm like, the not breaking through was just getting at me.
And I found like she broke through and there wasn't anything that interesting. There was a little oil. We've already seen oil come out of her nipples and other places. If there was something interesting, like if a spark plug had popped out.
Radio antenna.
Yeah, radio antenna, and you know, anything.
Fuzzy dice.
Keys.
You have a cool car baby, though. I did like the car baby.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there's the sequel.
I want that sequel for sure.
Yeah, it's gonna be like what was the Adam Driver joint? It's gonna be like that.
Annette.
Annette.
Yeah. Yep. Annette. The car baby is gonna be singing opera to enormous houses. This. So now Alonso's going to retract, and Iffy's going to retract everything they said about Sonic the Hedgehog, because now
I was just about to say that, because I definitely am getting ready for the FBCU, Fake Baby Cinematic Universe, and definitely we're going to ship Annette with Tatan Baby, and they're going to be boyfriend and girlfriend. One is wood, one is metal. How will the love last? I'm back on board with Cinematic Universe.
Excellent.
I guess we got to review this thing before I start really breaking down the FBCU.
I'm a screen it. I'll tell you, I saw this at home when I reviewed it, but I would love to see it in a theater. I think that DiCorno is doing a lot with sound here. I think visually it's really extraordinary. We have not mentioned the two leads who are so great. Agatha Roussel, who's never really acted much before. It's like mainly a dancer. She has such a challenging role and just nails it, I think, throughout. And then the great Vincent Landon as the fire chief. They're both terrific. I think this is a really extraordinary movie, and I think that again, Julie DuCorneau is just such an exciting filmmaker, and I cannot wait to see where she takes us next.
I'm under that. I'm at the stream it. This is a movie that falls into that. Wow, I respect this movie a lot more than I enjoyed this movie. And I think that she's such a talent. And as you guys know, and we've discussed many times here, I would so much rather support, encourage, and see bold, original, innovative filmmaking than like competent treading. And nothing about her is aiming for like mediocre accessibility. And I applaud that. I'm grateful for that in the sort of film artistry realm, but I was like oh my gosh, I have to text all my friends back in the Midwest, you guys are never gonna believe what she's doing with the car now. Like it was a little outside of my comfort zone, but I'm grateful that it exists.
Well, and I would say if you're a fan of the Cronenberg universe of films and filmmaking, then stream it. Otherwise, I'd say avoid it. I agree with you guys both. The acting is really good. The filmmaking is interesting. I'm curious to see if they make Tatan 2. And if she doesn't, somebody should. Because really, I want to see what happens to that car baby.
And I'm definitely a screen it. This seems like the most perfect fun 6 o'clock movie drinks after experience. Just sitting around a bar talking about this movie is just making me excited. And I need this film to really gain popularity, because I need to get the actor Vincent Linden to go toe-to-toe shirtless with Christopher Maloney for hottest dad. So
get out of my diary, Iffy.
For me to make that movie, we need y'all to see this movie. Yes. So check that out. But we got a lot more show, but we do got a lot more break. Well, just this one break. We'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun. So sit right there.
Hi, I'm Biz, host of One Bad Mother. Whether you're a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent.
I signed my stepson up for a camp that is actually in another state. I feel really stupid, and I don't think we're going to get the money back.
And then he found out that the car manual is a book about cars, so now he's reading our car manual.
So join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job. Download One Bad Mother on MaximumFun.org, and yes, there will be swears.
Hey there, beautiful people. I'm Travelle Anderson.
And I'm Jared Hill. We are the hosts of Fanti, the show where we have complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the things that we really, really love sometimes, but also have some problematic feelings about.
Yes, we get into it all. You want to know our thoughts about Nicki Minaj and all her foolishness? We got you. You want to know our thoughts about gentrification and perhaps some positive aspects of gentrification. We get into that too. Every single Thursday, you can check us out at MaximumFun.org. Listen, you know you want it, honey, so come on and get it. Period.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Todd Mezzaro,
Drea Clark.
Titan was not a movie about cars, but some car stuff definitely went down. And today we're going to celebrate some movie cars by once again proposing a new addition to the Hall of Excellence.
You're not going to get residuals on this song.
This is so titane.
Hall of Excellence.
If you saw the video clip that went to with that song, you would really understand why.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, spent sorry, so much you're time only getting the song.
The montage, yeah. Really.
Chef's kiss. So the category is Best Movie Car. Take that to mean what you will. Best looking car, most memorable car, best performance by a car in a motion picture. Let's see who our candidates will be. Who's going to kick us off?
I'll go first. Okay, my best movie car... Herbie the Love Bug. Herbie the Love Bug launched the idea of a franchise, a cinematic universe, our theme for today, that cycles around a single entity. And that entity is a VW Bug with a personality and the number 53 on its hood, I believe. I really hope I'm right on that number. Okay, good. Yeah, this started in like 1965. I think there were four Herbie movies, including, of course, obviously, probably Oscar nominated Herbie, like Full Throttle or whatever with Lindsay Lohan. What was the Herbie? Fully Loaded. There was 1965 through Lindsay Lohan's. So she was the last of the Herbies.
For now,
Full you're throttle, right, Alonzo.
Think what Titan could do with that title.
That's true.
Fully Loaded, actually. But I'm
Charlie's
sure they that
Angels
too.
Already stole Full
there
Throttle.
There you go. I thought you were going to go right to Herbie Goes Bananas because that's such a great title. But, you know.
No, it really is. They're all so good. Herbie the Love Bug. Plus, it has love right there in the title. So I just want you to think, like, if you're thinking of a car... Because, you know, our audience votes on these, Todd. So the pressure's really high on those of us who have to put up things multiple times. Herbie the Love Bug, just think of the joy that gives you and and the just iconic look of that little sweet precious car. No, That's mine.
I adore Herbie. And don't send us letters. 1968 is when the first Love Bug
movie, thank you.
Was released. I had a tough time with this one because I was like, do I go with a car with agency like, you know, Herbie or Christine, as was previously mentioned? Do I go with one who just knows how to hold a close-up like the Saab in Drive My Car, which, you know, believe me, that people all around the world are suddenly wanting like a tomato red, you know, Saab 900, whatever the hell kind of car that
classic.
Is. Gorgeous, gorgeous car. I kind of split the difference. I went with a car that, you know, kind of has a mind of its own, but also like sort of needs some guidance and has, I think, a really classic look and also a theme song. And so I went with the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh, yeah, you did.
I was just wanting and hoping that you would say that. That's a great one. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. We love you.
It's a great song. It spawned a stage musical even. Has fabulous. Wings, flies. Like, for me, the best part of watching Belfast was watching them watch Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yes.
Yes.
Agreed.
It's a great, cool, old, antique, like, you know, I'd have to look it up, but it's like some sort of kind of like 1910s car, like one of those really sort of beautiful, elaborate, ridiculous early versions of the automobile. And it's a convertible and it's just like.
And it flies, for God's sake.
And it flies. Yes. So, that put me down for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
You want to go, Iffy?
I'll draw, you know, because it was hard for me because, you know, obviously my heart really would love to say, you know, the Skyline R34 that we see in Too Fast, Too Furious. It was one that hit the scene and made all the tuners all around wish they could import a Skyline and bring it out. And some tuners, went on to not know that the Infiniti G35 was a Skyline hiding under our noses this whole time. Much like me, until I looked it up and was like, why does the new R35 look like an Infiniti G35? And I was like, anyway, I had to pick between that or I was thinking maybe the Mini Cooper from the Italian Job, because that made many people want to rush and grab a Mini Cooper. But we're talking about iconic cars, cars that you may not even be able to get. So that's why I had to say the Batmobile from the Tim Burton Batman.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
I would have gone with the 1968 myself, but, you know, we all have our brothers. Exactly.
Yeah, that's my pick.
That's a good one, man. Because it shoots out the claw, and he makes like a right angle turn, which is impossible.
Like a grappling hook fulcrum.
That's what I was looking for. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
And it's got that whole sort of Art Deco like kind of curve line to it. You know,
it's beautiful. Yeah, we built one on MythBusters and
driven
through the streets of San Francisco and got pulled over by a police officer because we had no license plates, no permits, no anything. And I talked our way out of getting arrested, and Tori and Carrie were thrilled because they thought they were going to jail.
Did you just explain you were on your way to solve crime?
No.
You were like, oh, I saw the symbol and I had to rush out. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Iffy, that's a great one. That was actually one of my on my list. Movie cars are like so iconic. You know, there's all the Bond Aston Martins, there's the Bullet Mustang.
Yep.
But I thought I wanted to pick one that wasn't quite as well known, maybe, but should be. And it's also one that I've seen in person. In action. So I'm picking, there's a bare metal Dodge Charger in Fast 7 that Dominic Toretto drives at the end of the movie when he says his final goodbye to Paul Walker that heart-wrenching scene. And the car, it's a one-of-one, custom-made car. It's fantastically beautiful, powerful, and sleek. And, you know, for Fast fans, like that's a key moment in the franchise history. So that car is just fantastically beautiful. It's made by a guy named Tom Nelson, Nelson Racing Engines, and it's a work of art. That's my nominee.
It's worth mentioning in the first Fast and Furious when they talk about how, you know, Dom has Nas for blood. I'm like, talk to the Titan lady if you want to talk about car fluids for blood. I believe you've been trumped here.
Can I give a small shout out to the Pontiac Fiero that goes to space in F9? Just an ugly car that did such great things.
One of my runners up would be the convertible VW Beetle that Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neill drive in the epic car chase at the end of What's Up, Doc.
Yes.
Which is what I was thinking of when you said you got pulled over in San Francisco. My God. That's immediately what came to mind.
I love that movie. That's a great one. There's also Jane Fonda's Porsche that she drives in Coming Home.
Oh, and Jake Ryan's Porsche in 16 Candles.
Oh, my God. Jake Ryan's car, for sure, that he leans against. Cars. Am I right, you guys?
Cars.
Detroit and Hollywood together again.
So you're going to have to go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/MaximumFilm to vote on which of these legendary automobiles is named to our Hall of Greatness.
Yes.
Hall of Excellence.
Hall of Excellence.
Got the spot. Yep.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's the one. And,
someone
go ahead, remix the song. Go ahead, clip it out, remix the song however you want, you cool kids. And post it on the Facebook. Yeah, make a dubstep. But, yeah, after y'all vote next week, we'll find out who is headed to the Hall of Excellence.
That was.
And now it's time for staff. What were you going to say, Drew?
I was just going to say that was an awesome slip up.
The Hall of Malaprops.
All right, y'all. It's time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Just let it rip.
Okay. I have one completely inspired by Titan, and I don't want to reveal too much because the reveal is a lot of it is a documentary from 2012 called The Imposter by director Bart Layton. It is currently on Canopy and I think Tubi and Peacock, and you can rent it. It is about a young Frenchman who is a con artist and a Texas family with a missing child 7 years younger than this young balding Frenchman believe him when he says that he's their missing child. And the documentary unfolds, and that's not even the craziest part. It is riveting weird stuff. And if you are in the mood for a little more French weirdness, give it a watch.
I like that. I think you ready, Alonzo?
Oh, sure. Yeah. No. So recently, there was a, you know, film Twitter gets bored and they like to ask deep questions of each other about movies. And a thing that went around recently was the name four films that you think that nobody likes as much as you do. And of course, a lot of people completely missed the assignment and were saying like Mad Max Fury Road. And it was like, no. We're talking about like obscure movies, forgotten movies, underloved movies. You know, and one of mine was a film that I first saw at the Sundance Film Festival. So in honor of Coda's big win this week, I wanted to recommend Take Me to the River from Matt Sobel. It is, let me put it this way. I watched this movie with Dave White, and Dave White can watch like Beheadings a Go-Go and the entirety of Titan and not flinch. He's just like, whatever. This like 85 minute exploration of one dysfunctional family made him so tense that by the end of it, he was like practically a knot on the couch. It is a deliciously discomforting film about family secrets and about just things that aren't being talked about and aren't being revealed. And it is a movie that I love. And for some reason, I can't figure out why. Like it just has slipped under so many people's radars. But I highly, highly recommend it. It, too, is on Tubi and Canopy and Roku Channel and a bunch of other places. And you definitely ought to check it out. Take Me to the River.
I'll back that up and I'll say second only to the film Nebraska by Alexander Payne. It's the most Nebraskan movie. I mean, the Nebraskan, like, polite tension. Woo, it's there. Yeah.
All right. Do you have one for us, Todd?
Well, this in keeping with a French theme, I've been thinking about French Lieutenant's Woman, which was a beautiful film written by Harold Pinter from the novel by John Foles. And it's, in my mind, one of the top 10 book-to-movie translations because it was one of the early ones that went back and forth in time between the making of the movie and the actual book itself. And so if you haven't seen French Lieutenant's Woman, I highly, highly recommend it. And haven't seen it in a while, recommend it still.
It's on HBO Max.
Oh, it's on HBO Max. Right.
If you, all our longtime listeners, we're going to get a treat from mine because it's one that I've been trying to recall for a long time. I've brought it up on a few episodes. There's no better time for it to be one of my staff picks than today. If you want French weirdness, you want to go all out. You know I'm going with 2004's Anatomy of Hell by Catherine Breillat.
No part of me knew that. I love that your lead up was, you guys know that I'm going with. I rarely know what you're going with.
Remember when I kept being like, there was that period, like that movie with the period blood, and I can't remember it.
Yep.
And you get, this is the movie. I finally found it. It turns out you have to search period sex, not period French film.
Oh, because
you're going to get a lot of corsets otherwise.
Yeah. It does not have great reviews, which is very funny, but I think that's just the patriarchy afraid of seeing insertion on camera with blood. involved.
If you can't handle terms like that, then these movies are not for you.
Yeah. I feel like it needs me to say that before you decide to jump into this movie, that this is, it is there. And it's definitely one of the super, like, when you're like, what's a French film? this is hella experimental.
How French are we talking here?
Yeah. I don't forgot. I remember I found it when I was just trying to find movies by looking on like weirdest movie list or like, you know, something. And it was on someone's list and it was a watch.
Oh, if you Googled Rocco Siffredi, just cop to it. Come on.
Yeah, you know me. That's at the tip of my fingers at every turn. But yeah, so that's my pick. And that's kind of how I felt about Titan, except this one, like Titan, I liked a lot better and definitely will recommend it a lot more than Anatomy of Hell. But it honestly fits. Right. But Todd, thank you so much for being game for this one and sitting through this film and lending your expertise with Otto.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me in. I'm not just a car guy. I'm a giant nerd. Like I know about outer space stuff. Ooh. I know about archaeology and history. Like
well, we know who our guest is for the Uncharted movie.
Is it so Titan?
It's not nearly Titan enough, I think.
Could use a little Titan. Well, Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. As always, fun to have y'all riding. If you, listener, I'm talking to you now, if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at @maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org or voice memo for the hotline. Our producer is Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.